You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Friday, so it's time for Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, on the line with us, taking your calls. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
So what's on your mind today?
Let's review a little bit of what's going on in the Senate. Mm-hmm. I think listeners will remember that last week an agreement was reached regarding the president's ability to appoint the EPA director, the Secretary of Labor, members of the National Labor Relations Board, and some other positions. That issue is about whether or not the President of the United States, whoever he or she may be, has the right to make appointments to his cabinet and to put his team together. The Republicans have been extremely obstructionist on this issue, drag it out, filibustered the issue, required 60 votes for the issue. The Majority Leader, Harry Reid, finally said, I think, long overdue, enough is enough. If you guys keep this up, I am going to change the rules, go for 51 votes, and we're going to get these appointments done. Republicans responded, this is the end of the world, it's terrible to change the rules, blah, 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 blah. An agreement was reached by which these appointments will be made. And that's a good thing. But the broader issue of the dysfunctionality of the Senate was not dealt with. And what that means is the Senate can function, in my view, in either one of two ways. Either you have, in a sense, a gentleman and a gentlelady's agreement that the rules of the Senate will not be abused. And by that I mean the nature of the Senate right now is that if I walk down onto the Senate floor and I say, I object, I don't want legislation to go forward, I can bring, as one senator, the entire Senate and by definition the Congress to a halt. And 99 other senators can do exactly the same thing. If those rules are abused, if people come down and do that time and time again, slow down the process, they are abusing the rules, in my view. And something has got to be done. So either you maintain a gentleman's agreement, so to speak, or then you're going to have to go to new rules, which say, guess what? One person cannot bring the United States Senate to a halt. Guess what? We do not need 60 votes on every single piece of legislation. I think perhaps the most important fact to know is that between 1917 and 1967, the filibuster was used 45 times during a 50-year period. Very, very, very rarely, less than once a year. Since Harry Reid has been majority leader in the last 6.5 years, he's had to try to overcome over 400 filibusters. And by a filibuster, I mean not somebody standing on the floor talking, but just somebody says that you're going to need 60 votes to move this legislation, because we're going to prevent it from going forward unless it has 60 votes. So bottom line here now in the Senate, in my view, is that we're looking at a tyranny of the minority, not majority rule. The minority must have rights to be protected. No debate about that. But right now, the majority is not doing what the American people want. So we are passing legislation, but we need, in the sense of getting over 50 votes, but we cannot get to 60 votes, and very, very, very little gets done. So that's one issue we have to stay on. How do you make the Senate a responsive institution to deal with the enormous problems facing our country of a collapsing middle class, high unemployment, dysfunctional healthcare system, et cetera, et cetera? And how do you do it in a way that the minority cannot prevent good things from happening? Issue number one. Issue number two that we're dealing with right now touches on a major, major problem in the United States, and that is the very high level of student indebtedness. Student indebtedness in this country now is over $1 trillion. It is higher than credit card debt. Average student graduating a four-year college is $27,000 in debt. If you go to graduate school, medical school, dental school, it could be, you know, 5-10 times as much as that. I've met dentists who are paying off a $200,000 plus loan. How do we deal with that? A few weeks ago, as a result of previous legislation, what we call the Stafford subsidized loan, that is the major loan going to low and moderate income students, the federal loan program, went from 3.4 to 6.8%. Many of us voted, here's an example, a majority of us voted to keep it at 3.4%. We did not have 60 votes. It went up to 6.8%. An agreement is now being, has been agreed to, so-called bipartisan agreement, which I have very serious problems with. It would tie student loans to 10-year treasury notes. Most people expect interest rates to go up. That could mean that in 5 or 6 years, students will be paying 6, 7, 8% interest rates on their student loans. And that, I think, is a dumb idea, given the fact that students already have too much indebtedness, and it will simply discourage young people from going to college, getting the education that they need. So that's an issue that we will be dealing with, I think, early next week. I've got an amendment that I think will significantly improve what is not a good piece of legislation, in my view. A third issue that is being discussed is the whole issue of tax reform. And, you know, when anyone talks about Social Security reform, tax reform, hang on to your wallet, because generally speaking, the big money interests in Washington are going to get what they want. Social Security reform is another word for cutting Social Security benefits. Medicare reform, cutting Medicare benefits, Medicaid benefits, and so forth and so on. Tax reform is another word for giving, in my view, even more tax benefits in a variety of ways to large multinational corporations. One of the reasons that we have a deficit crisis is that over the years, large corporations have been able to get huge tax breaks, including the ability to stash their money in the Cayman Islands and other tax havens, where they're putting billions and billions of dollars, and they don't have to pay a nickel in taxes on that. We're losing about $100 billion a year just from that one provision by which they're able to store their money in the Cayman Islands. So when we talk about tax reform, what you should know is that corporations are now flooding. They're flooding the Congress right now, trying to get even more tax breaks, more benefits, lower tax rates, all of which I think will be a bad, bad thing for this country. One out of four major corporations today pay zero in taxes. Corporations are paying about 12% tax rates on their profits right now. So what you'll hear in the newspapers and on television is, oh my goodness, they have a 35% corporate tax rate. But the answer is, that's the nominal rate. Nobody pays it, or very, very, very few people pay it. Sometimes they pay zero, sometimes they pay 5%. Average, it's about 12%. So what we have seen over the years is corporate contribution as a percentage of total tax revenue is way lower than it used to be, has been picked up by individuals. We've got problems with the individual tax rates as well. But focusing on corporate taxes to make sure that we have a tax system that is fair, that large profitable corporations, and today corporate America is enjoying record-breaking profits, start paying their fair share, is also a major issue.
Okay. Just a half a minute left, Bernie. Thoughts on Trayvon Martin?
I think what you had is a tragedy. I think it gets back primarily to, what is it called, Stand Your Ground.
Yeah.
I think that is just an incredibly stupid and dangerous piece of legislation that condones what happened there in Florida.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls in our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman program. It's called Brunch with Bernie. Check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
And, of course, you can drop into our free live chat room over at tomhartman.com, and we have a free app over in the App Store for iPhones and iPads. 20 minutes past the hour here on the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. Jason in Washington, D.C., you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, guys. I just realized that the other day the NDAA provision is now reestablished so that the military can indefinitely detain any American citizen without there being any due process of the law. I thought I had voted for Obama because he was going to protect our civil liberties, and every time I turn around, it's looking like he's actually worse than Bush on a lot of this stuff. As a matter of fact, I don't think it was me, but the ACLU on their 10-year anniversary said that Obama's been terrible on this stuff and is actually worse than Bush, and I was surprised the ACLU said that. So I'm fearful that we're running down this road of a military type of tyranny or government control of stuff with the censorship of the internet, the war on all of the whistleblowers. What are we going to do to clean up our government? Because it seems like the one thing both Republicans and Democrats don't want is they do not want transparency.
Well, I think, you know, when you ask about how you clean up government, I would rephrase that and say, yeah, clean it up and make it responsive to the needs of ordinary people, not the big money interests who currently control it. In terms of the whole issue of civil liberties, it is a huge, huge, huge issue. And I would agree with the assertion that the President Obama has not been good on this issue, to say the least. I think he inherited a number of programs from Bush, initiated during the Bush era, and in some cases he has expanded those programs. And that concerns me very much. But also understand, this is not just a government issue, it is a corporate issue. Bottom line here is as a result of the explosion of technology in recent years, you know, private companies, government knows just an enormous amount about you. And if we are serious about being a quote-unquote free country or believing in liberty and individual rights, that is an enormously dangerous direction in which to go. Now, what I will tell you is that in terms of the USA Patriot Act and what we heard recently about the fact that virtually every phone call made in the United States of America is on file. That doesn't mean that they're listening in. It means that there is a record of when you made that call and to whom you made that call. I think that is absurd. I think, as I've said many times, obviously we want to go after people who will do us harm. We want to go after people who are terrorists. But the idea that you have on file every phone call made in the United States of America, 99.99% of the American people have nothing to do with terrorism, is to me dead wrong. So what we are going to do, I believe the strategy is when the Department of Defense reauthorization bill comes up, is work on the USA Patriot Act, specifically Section 215, and tighten that up significantly. And basically to say that if the law enforcement folks or the intelligence people have a reason to believe that somebody is involved in terrorist activity, they go to the court, the FISA court, and they give their reasons. And if the court says you've made your case, go after that person, they go after that person. That is a very different process than having on file every phone call made in the United States and having blanket the ability of the government to go into people's websites, et cetera, et cetera. So that's kind of what we'll be doing and probably working on an amendment during the Department of Defense reauthorization bill.
Dan in San Diego, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Morning, Senator Sanders and Tom. Yeah, I had a question. In the IRS investigation, I think Darrell Issa perpetrated a fraud on the country when he claimed that conservative groups were targeted by the IRS, when the reality is he only asked for data on conservative groups. And I'm wondering, can he be charged with anything? You know, if you recall, when the issue first came out, John Boehner asked, who's going to jail? And I think Issa should go to jail, or at a minimum, he should be charged with ethics violations and, you know, removed at least from the committee chair. What's your opinion on that?
Well, what I could tell you is it certainly is not going to happen. He has, you know, been one of their, you know, a very, very aggressive folks. I'm sure he's close to the speaker, so I think he's going to stay in his position. But your point is well taken. What later information indicates is that progressive groups have also been impacted by those IRS investigations. But here's the most important point. You know, it gets almost back to the Trayvon Martin case, where you have, you know, the stand your ground legislation, which almost, I wouldn't say encourages, but yeah, maybe encourages folks to be much more violent than they otherwise should be. What you have right now in terms of campaign finance, you have these stupid laws which are designed to encourage quote-unquote social welfare, but which everybody in the world knows that they are meant for campaign finance. So the problem with this whole IRS investigation has to do with campaign funding and ways for people to fund elections and the political process in secret. And if we are serious about transparency, and in fact, if you are serious about the political process, we got to end those stupid laws which allow people to put huge amounts of money into the political process without any disclosure at all. That is the remedy to that problem.
Okay. Chris in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I wanted to ask you if you would favor taking back the money power from the banksters, you know, nationalizing basically money. And we could fund government, local, state, and federal interest-free. You know, Dennis Kucinich had a bill up that did just that. What's your opinion on that?
Well, that's not the direction that I would go, Chris. This is what I would do. First of all, I believe that the economy of the United States, in terms at least of the health and welfare of the middle class of this country and working families of this country, is never going to be satisfactorily addressed unless we deal with Wall Street. And we don't talk about it enough. I applaud the folks at Occupy Wall Street for focusing on it. They were right. That effort has got to expand and continue. I guess we'll pick this up after the break.
We'll do that. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting. With Senator Sanders, you can check out his website, sign up for the Bernie Buzz, read the news of the day over at sanders.senate.gov. Stick around. We'll be right back. 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In our next hour, by the way, Pastor D. Alexander Bullock is going to be back with us talking about the Detroit bankruptcy and what's going on there. And it's an Indos Friday. The place where despair is not an option. A marvelous line that I stole from Senator Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls on issues of the day. And Bernie, we started with an issue just before we went to break. You want to?
Right. Chris called about Wall Street. And while I don't particularly wouldn't go in the direction that he proposed, here's what we have to understand, and never forget, not for one day. Wall Street is enormously powerful. I mean, you can talk about the oil companies, you can talk about the high-tech companies, the information technology companies, all of which are, you know, incredibly powerful. But at the top of that whole list is Wall Street. I cannot imagine, Tom, almost any piece of legislation passing the Congress or being supported by the president that Wall Street opposes. These guys, I mean, you know, look at legislation when it's passed and find out, you know, Wall Street doesn't stay up nights worrying about guns. They don't worry about gay rights too much or abortion, all that stuff. That's not their issue. But on economic issues, stuff that impacts them, it ain't going to happen. They're just too powerful. And here's just a few points that people should be aware of. We bailed out Wall Street, both in terms of the TARP bailout and huge amounts of zero or low interest loans from the Fed, because of their greed, recklessness, and illegal behavior, and because they were too big to fail. Everybody should understand that every one of the major financial institutions, many of them enjoying record-breaking profits right now, is larger than they were before we bailed them out. So if they were too big to be bailed out, then imagine what's going to happen in the future. Second of all, people should appreciate that the six largest financial institutions have assets equivalent to over $9 trillion, and that is two-thirds of the GDP of the United States of America. That's six financial institutions. And thirdly, of course, we're talking about international capital and the huge impact they're having on economies all over the world. So if you are serious about figuring out how we reverse the collapse of the middle class, how we create a full employment economy, how we make sure that working people enjoy decent wages, how the labor movement becomes revitalized so people have the right to have collective bargaining. If you talk about any or all of these things, you got to appreciate that the power of Wall Street and their opposition to any and all of these provisions. Interestingly enough, Wall Street along with other large corporate interests, constitutes what's called the Business Roundtable. Business Roundtable is an organization of CEOs of the largest corporations in America. And these guys are now promoting the idea that we should raise the retirement age for Social Security and for Medicare to be 70 years of age. In other words, they want to destroy Social Security for millions of people and Medicare as well. Bottom line, there is a class war going on being led by Wall Street. These guys are, they're very religious people, but their religion is greed. More, 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 and they don't care who they destroy if it gets in their way of making even more short-term profits. So, you know, we are, among many other things, I have introduced legislation, others have done similar type pieces of legislation to start breaking up these huge financial institutions. If they're too big to fail, they're too big to exist, and we can have, I think, a more competitive economy, and certainly dilute the power of these very, very powerful folks if we break them up.
John in Venice, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders.
John, if you're on a speakerphone, you need to pick it up and do it normally.
You know, the debate right now about the Cassandra Ground Law, I believe that was paid for through ALEC by the NRA, and sales have gone up in Florida of guns since. I might be wrong about that. Do you understand that to be the case?
Well, you know, what ALEC is another tool of, I think, the Koch brothers. I think that's true, Tom. Isn't it the Koch brothers?
Well, the Koch brothers are one of many funders.
Yeah,
it started back in the 80s.
We shouldn't. It's not a conspiracy. What it is simply, you know, the right-wing groups, Koch brothers and others, come together. And they say, okay, how do we make state government more responsive to the needs of the wealthy and the powerful? How do we break unions? How do we lower environmental standards? How do we cut programs that are of benefit to working people? So what they do through the ALEC program is they come up with a list of kind of generic ideas. They send it out to conservative legislators, right-wing legislators all over the country. They supply the expert witnesses that may be needed for committee hearings and so forth and so on. And the day-to-day political capabilities of getting that legislation through. That's what they do. You know, this stand your ground stuff, you know, it seems to me that what we want is a less violent society. We know that guns are taking so many innocent lives in this country. We know that we're a very violent society. To give people more encouragement to, quote-unquote, defend yourself. You know, self-defense is a basic human right. Somebody attacks you, you have a right, obviously, to defend yourself. But you don't have a right to go shooting somebody because they looked at you in the wrong way or they said something stupid to you. You know, we want to protect human life, not take human life. So I'm not a great fan of this type of legislation. I understand the president just spoke about that, coming from a similar tone.
Mm, yeah, he did. John, in Westfield, Vermont, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator. Elizabeth Warren and Senator McCain have starting what I guess you could call a modernized Glass-Steagall Act. Are you going to be a sponsor of that with them, and are you going to back that attempt to get that through?
Well, I think that's what they're talking about is developing a new type of a Glass-Steagall legislation. Yes, I do support that. But frankly, I think we have to go further and not only put up walls between commercial and investor banks and insurance companies, which is what Glass-Steagall is about, and that's a good thing. But as I said a moment ago, I think you have to break these financial institutions up. That's long-term what we've got to do. But yes, I do support that legislation.
Howard, in Hollywood, Florida, you're on the air, Senator Sanders.
How you guys doing? I've got a suggestion. I've made them before. You tend to laugh at them because they're coming a little bit from left field. But I've got a way of challenging the Republicans so that you can pass a jobs bill. They have 35 jobs bills in the Senate that aren't being passed. We've got them in the House in committee. I suggest Obama come forward and make an offer. You pick your best bill in the Senate. You allow us to pick our best bill that's in committee. You bring it out of committee and pass it we put them both in the Senate and pass them simultaneously. That way the Republicans can no longer say that we're in favor of a jobs bill and not do anything, because their jobs bills are ridiculous, most of them that I've read anyway.
Right.
How is that for making a suggestion?
Well, thank you. I mean, I think if the point is to expose the fact that our Republican friends are not seriously interested in dealing with the jobs crisis in America, you're absolutely right. And I guess any way that one could expose them, put them on the defensive on that issue, it would be appropriate. But I think most people understand that. I just want to repeat a point, Tom, that I've made before. You know, when we talk about the economy today, two basic truths are there. Number one, are we better today than we were when Bush left office? And the answer is yes, we certainly are. We were hemorrhaging 700,000 jobs a month during that period. That is unsustainable. It is total disaster. Today we're growing about 200,000 jobs a month. Not very good, but obviously a lot better than losing 700,000 jobs a month. But having said that we are making some modest progress, we should not underestimate the seriousness of the financial crisis facing this country in terms of jobs. Real unemployment is not 7.5%. Real unemployment, including those people who have given up looking for work, those people who are working part-time, is close to 14%. If you're young and just have a high school degree, it is a lot higher than that. If you're a person of color, it is a lot higher than that. Furthermore, many of the new jobs that are being created are not 40-hour-a-week jobs. They're 30-hour-a-week jobs. Many of the jobs being created are temporary jobs, not permanent jobs. So we have a major, major jobs crisis in this country that the Congress has got to address. And it pains me very much that they haven't done that. One of the quick and easy ways that you can start creating millions of jobs is by rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. Everybody knows that our roads, our bridges, our tunnels, our rail system, airports need enormous amount of work. That work really constitutes all kinds of different jobs. It's not just blue-collar jobs. But we can create a lot of work doing that. We can create work dealing with global warming, moving away from fossil fuel, moving to wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, energy efficiency. Do those things create jobs? Will the Republicans be supportive of that? Sadly, I doubt it.
Yeah. Bernie, 30 seconds. Is there any effort to push those things forward that might have some success?
There sure is. There sure is. I have working with the chairman of the Energy Committee, Ron Wyden, and others are doing similar type efforts. Gene Shaheen in New Hampshire has a piece of legislation and to call for significant spending on energy efficiency. We are wasting huge amounts of money by not having our homes properly weatherized, and we can save consumers money, create jobs, and cut greenhouse gas emissions if we move aggressively in that area.
We will be back with more of your questions for Senator Bernie Sanders in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, right here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's 15 minutes before the hour. Bernie's website is sanders.senate.gov. And they've got a great news site there that's updated on a regular basis every single day. Plus, you can sign up for Bernie's newsletter, Bernie Buzz.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
Once again, that's sanders.senate.gov. Check it out. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Yeah, it's a joke. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Robert in Bothell, Washington. You are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Yeah. Good afternoon, gentlemen. It's an honor. I've spoken with Tom several times, but Bernie, I have an idea, and I wanted to run it by you guys. What would happen if somebody slightly independent of Wall Street formed a bank specializing in low-interest student loans, say the tribal nations or somebody that's, you know, would like to do something a little different?
Well,
is that feasible?
If the tribes wanted to do that, I suppose, yes. I mean, people have the right to form a bank and develop their own policies. Yes, Robert, I think that is feasible. And as I said a moment ago, I am very, very, very worried about these high interest rates that young people are now and their families are being forced to pay. We want to encourage people to go to college, not discourage them. So you've thrown out an idea. Tom, you know, when Robert was talking and mentioned an idea, I just want to repeat something. I think I made this point before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, citizens' ideas have an impact. You may or may not recall that a couple of years ago on this program, a woman called up who was a veteran. And she said, I walked into a veteran's hospital, VA hospital. And I was really upset. I went to the gift shop, and most of the stuff there was made in China or was not made in America. Well, I'm chairman of the Veterans Committee right now, and we have worked on that issue. And I hope that that woman who called goes into her local VA hospital and notices a difference, because the VA's contractor now is moving fairly aggressively to make sure that we have more Made in America products in our VA hospitals and facilities. And we have also done that in the Smithsonian Institute. So sometimes ideas that come forward end up in making changes in our country.
That is absolutely great. Jim, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening to Minnesota's Progressive Talk, you are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hi. Can you please explain the relationship between banks being too big and the destruction of the middle class?
Yeah. When you have a handful of financial institutions that wield enormous economic and political power, they take actions which benefit themselves, not the rest of the country. And what has happened over the years and where we are right now is what traditional banking was about. So you put your money into a bank, the bank lends it out for housing, small business, create jobs in the community. The banks were part of what we call the productive economy, helping people buy homes, helping businesses produce products and services. Today, Wall Street is something entirely different. What Wall Street is about to a significant degree is an island unto itself, where its goal is to make money for itself, often through incredibly complicated financial transactions, rather than investing in the productive economy and creating jobs for the middle class. That's one area. Second area is you have banks which charge very, very high interest rates. I mean, you're looking at banks that are charge interest rates of 20 or 25% on credit cards. That is very deleterious to ordinary people. Thirdly, what you have is a situation today where Wall Street is sitting on hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, which they are not investing into the productive economy. So those are just, and fourthly, I would say, Wall Street's money and power flows into the political system to a significant degree. And they have a whole lot of say about what the President of the United States does, what does not do, and who gets elected to Congress by shaping campaign contributions that go to certain people and not to other people.
Elijah in San Saba, Texas, here on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders, do you remember the 1992 election?
Yep.
Do you remember what Ross Perot told the American people when he was running against Bill Clinton?
Yep, I do, actually.
He said, you let the free trade agreements pass in this country, and you're going to hear a sucking sound. It's going to suck every job in this country out. Now, what has happened?
Well, I think, Elijah, you make a very, very good point. And I know Ross Perot was laughed at. The Democrats disagreed with him. That was, in fact, Vice Presidential candidate Al Gore, I think, had a debate with him. And the Republican candidate, George Bush, President Bush, disagreed with him as well. But the truth is, as I think Elijah and Ross Perot told us, trade agreements, these unfettered free trade agreements, starting with NAFTA and CAFTA and permanent normal trade relations with China and others, primarily written by large corporations with the goal of making it easier for them to shut down in America, move abroad, hire people at low wages, and then be able to bring their products back into this country tariff-free. So I would agree with Elijah that one of the reasons, not the only one, that we are seeing a collapsing middle class, that wages are going down, has to do with these disastrous trade agreements. I think other reasons have to do with, and not unrelated, by the way, because a lot of the, we have lost over 50,000 manufacturing plants in this country in the last 10 years, and you've seen a decline in trade unionism in this country, the inability of workers to stand up and protect their rights. So a lot of factors out there for the decline of the middle class, but certainly these unfettered free trade agreements are one of them, and I will tell you, Elijah, there's not one of them that I've ever voted for.
Yeah. Bernie, just 20 seconds left here. Thoughts for the week?
Yeah, let's pay attention this coming week to the student loan legislation. I hope that we can significantly change the bill that's currently before the Senate and create a situation that we move toward over the next couple of years, making college affordable for all young people, for all people, not just young people, in this country.
Senator Sanders, thanks so much for being with us again.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Sanders.Senate.gov, Bernie's website. Be sure to check it out. We'll be back with Pastor D. Alexander Bullock about what's going on in Detroit, and then Anything Goes Friday. Your calls. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. The big news, well, actually, there's a lot of big news. I want to get to President Obama's speech as well in a short while. But the immediate big news is Detroit just went down in flames, courtesy of, frankly, in my opinion, courtesy of 30 years of Reaganomics. And, you know, shipping our jobs overseas and offshoring our jobs and not protecting our domestic economy, including and in particular our auto industry. But, you know, we can get into that another time. But it finally has reached an apotheosis, or however you say that word, a peak, in that the city of Detroit is filing for Chapter 9 bankruptcy. So I wanted to get on somebody who really knows what's going on the ground there, who has been one of our great resources for all things Michigan, and particularly what's going on in Detroit here. Pastor D. Alexander Bullock, the founder and national spokesperson for the Change Agent Consortium, which you can find over at facebook.com/ActionCAC, as in Change Agent Consortium, ActionCAC. Reverend Bullock, or Pastor Bullock, welcome back to the program.
Tom, thank you so much for having me back. Good to be here.
It is always an honor and a pleasure to have you on our air, sir. So tell us what's going on in Detroit.
I tell you what, it is chaos. It is almost unbelievable. This weekend I was floored by the not guilty verdict in the Trayvon Martin case. And I haven't even made it through the week before I'm floored again by Kevin Orr and Governor Rick Snyder filing for Chapter 9 bankruptcy in the city of Detroit. Now, remember, this is the same governor who's on record saying bankruptcy would never work for Michigan cities. He would not stand behind the filing for bankruptcy. And, of course, he lied. And we're headed that way. Now, why did this happen? One of the reasons why this happened is because on Monday, the pension board, suing emergency manager Kevin Orr, had a case that was going to be heard, and that case was going to deal with whether or not retirees' pensions can be altered or modified and what can be done with their health care benefits. And a judge was going to decide on whether or not Kevin Orr had any power over that unsecured debt to touch those pensions. And so we believe that this is a kind of preemptive chess move to file for bankruptcy to stop the ability of the pension board to have that case heard on Monday.
Wow.
And so just a continued
So let me get this right. They were planning on stealing the pensions and health benefits of Detroit's retirees, money that these people paid into this system throughout their working lives so that when they retired, there would be something available to them. and Kevin Orr and Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan, the Republicans in Michigan, were fixing to lay their hands on this money. And you took on the good people of Detroit were taking them to court. And so to avoid having to defend that or possibly even losing the ability to lay their hands on that money, instead they're going to declare bankruptcy and through bankruptcy tell all the pensioners in Detroit, sorry, tough luck, you're screwed?
Exactly, right? So they file for bankruptcy, which potentially blocks the case being heard Monday. And then under bankruptcy, all of the unsecured debt is on the table. Well, what's wow. that? Pensions. So...
Yeah.
And then today they announced that who do they want to lead the charge and shepherd the city of Detroit through the bankruptcy process? That's right. You guessed it. Emergency manager Kevin Orr.
Right.
And so this is what's going on in Detroit. We've been in a whirlwind of confusion and of complexity the last 24 hours.
So the governor said that preventing bankruptcy in Detroit was such a high priority and was so important that it was that he was willing to end democracy in Detroit. He was willing to fire all the elected officials or strip them of all their elected authority and power, all their constitutional power, all their power by virtue of the incorporations of the various townships and counties and whatnot, especially with regard to Detroit in this case. He was willing to do that, end democracy in Detroit, in order to avoid bankruptcy. And then as soon as he tries to get his grubby little fingers on the pension funds and the health care funds for retired workers, and you guys say, hey, wait a minute, he says, oh, yeah, bankruptcy, cool, we're going to do that because we can you know, take that money that way.
Exactly, right? His tune has always been bankruptcy is bad for the city. I don't believe in bankruptcy. We're not headed that way. Then all of a sudden when the plan changes,
right.
the pension boards sues the emergency manager, all of a sudden bankruptcy becomes a viable option. Now, when the insurance company sued, they worked out a deal. They negotiated.
Right.
So when the casinos began to challenge what the emergency manager was saying, they negotiated. They worked out a deal.
So but those are big corporations. They aren't average working people.
That's right. This is an attack on average working people, on retirees, on their health care benefits, on citizens in the city of Detroit. And I believe now Detroit takes center stage, and now the question becomes, will the United States of America be a place where the sanctity of contracts, where the promises made to retirees with respect to their pensions and health care benefits will be honored, or has the United States become a country where big business interest now is going to be able to go in, and much like tomb robbers raid sacred tombs, go in and raid retirees' pensions and health care benefits. This is a critical time, not just for Detroit, but for the nation.
Now, I did see one headline that said that a judge had paused or halted this bankruptcy proceeding. Do I have that right, or was it a partial thing, or was it just a speculation? What's going on with that?
Oh, that's right. Recent breaking news, a judge has issued an opinion that the filing for bankruptcy was unconstitutional according to the Michigan State Constitution. It has asked the governor to tell emergency manager Kevin Orr to cease and desist and stop. Of course, the governor cannot be held in contempt for not obeying that order, in which case it doesn't really have much teeth, but at least you have a judge putting an opinion out there and making the right judgment. But again, this tug of war that we're involved in now, I think has ramifications far beyond the city of Detroit.
I absolutely agree. I mean, you end democracy anywhere in the United States, and you have the potential to end democracy everywhere in the United States. It's incredible. We're talking with the pastor, D. Alexander Bullock, the founder and national spokesperson of the Change Agent Consortium, facebook.com/actionCAC. What can people who are watching or listening right now do to help you all out, basically? If they're not in Detroit, or if they are in Detroit, what should they do? And if they're not in Detroit, what can they do to help out? We have just a minute here, sir.
Great question. Go to the Facebook page, please, actioncac.org. Excuse me, that's the website, actioncac.org. Facebook Action CAC, Change Agent Consortium. One, get informed, go to the website and sign up, join the database. We've got a lot of information coming out. But also get connected, because we're going to be calling on folks from around the country to come to Detroit. We need to occupy Detroit. We're going to have to up the ante and really demonstrate and let Governor Snyder and Kevin Orr know that we're not going away, but that we're going to fight for the livelihood of the retirees, the working people, and the citizens of the city. And so when we make that call, Tom, we're going to need folks from around the nation to come to Detroit and stand with us.
So you have a website that's actioncac.org as well.
That's right.
I did not have that on my notes. My apologies for that. So actioncac.org or facebook.com/actioncac. Pastor D. Alexander Bullock, sir, you are always, it's inspiring, the energy and passion and activism that you are bringing to these issues, a voice of truth. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us. And get thee over to actioncac.org. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's Anything Goes Friday, although I've got to tell you about the president's speech today, or his press conference. It was amazing. We'll be back with that. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. So President Obama did a press conference today. And I've got to say, I've been writing about this for 3 or 4 days from a variety. I've been basically saying the same thing from a variety of different ways, which is that, I mean, yesterday, you know, we did this whole not semi-tongue-in-cheek, you know, if the NRA thinks that the only solution to a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun, then the NRA should be, should have been arming Trayvon Martin, and they should be, you know, starting a program to make sure that every young black man in America who might be the victim of profiling and being attacked by somebody like George Zimmerman will have a gun that they can pull out. Obviously it's not something that I support. I don't think that I don't think we should do this for black people, white people, we should not be increasing the number of guns in America. But, you know, if you follow their logic, now why is it that they, you know, Ted Nugent is going, oh yeah, I love my gun, and, you know, Rick Perry shooting his guns and all this stuff. Are they just talking about guns for white people? Well, I think, frankly, they are. And I think, you know, in fact, back when Reagan was governor of California and the Black Panthers started arming up and talking about it and pictures of it started showing up on TV that they were legally buying weapons, all of a sudden Ronald Reagan rushed in and pushed through and signed gun control legislation in California. Totally freaked him out. This was back in the 70s. So anyhow, I talked about that. I talked about how there were two standards of justice applied in the George Zimmerman case, because there were really two people on trial. You could say George Zimmerman was on trial, and when I published this piece, there were a number of people who the nannery nadobs responded to it, saying, how can you say Trayvon Martin was on trial? He's dead. He wasn't on trial. Well, actually, he was on trial, because in order to determine whether or not George Zimmerman was defending himself, the jury first had to determine whether or not Trayvon Martin was a threat to George Zimmerman. Because if George Zimmerman was not being threatened, he could not claim self-defense. So there were really two trials going on at the same time. There was a trial of Trayvon Martin. Was he a threat, or was he just an innocent kid walking home? And then if he was a threat, there was the trial of George Zimmerman. Was he justified in using self-defense, and as part of that self-defense, pulling a gun out and putting a bullet through Trayvon Martin's heart? And we all know how the verdict came out, but my point was that there were two standards of justice used. That the standard of justice that was used by which George Zimmerman was judged, both in the courtroom and in the media in the United States, was the post 2006 Koch brothers, Jeb Bush, NRA, Alec, stand your ground and shoot first law, was that post 2006 standard of, if you feel afraid, it need not even be an actual threat. If you believe yourself to be at risk, and not even of death, just of great bodily harm, if you believed yourself to be at risk of that, you have the right to kill the other person. So that was the standard that was used for George Zimmerman, and the jury came back and said, yes, he had the right to kill Trayvon Martin because he felt that Trayvon Martin represented a threat to him. Okay, so that was that standard of justice. The second standard of justice was the pre-2006 standard of justice, which was applied in this case, which was before the Stand Your Ground and Shoot First law was passed, which explicitly said if you feel that you are at threat of great bodily harm or even death, your first obligation before you use deadly force, your first obligation is to do everything in your power, including running, to avoid the confrontation. And that standard of justice, that pre-Koch brothers, pre-Jeb Bush, pre-Stand Your Ground and Shoot First, pre-Alec, that standard of justice was the one that was used to judge Trayvon Martin. Because over and over and over again, people were saying, why didn't he just run home? It's essentially what Don West said in the courtroom, or the other lawyer, whatever his name was, one of the defense lawyers, basically said, let's have 4 minutes of silence, because that 4 minutes, Trayvon Martin could have run away. So, my word's not his, but I think I'm doing a pretty good job of capturing the essence of what he said. And so the standard of justice by which Trayvon Martin was judged was he should have run away instead of using deadly force. Nobody suggested that Trayvon Martin had the right to stand his ground, and that he was therefore completely justified in whatever he did to George Zimmerman, assuming that he did something, up to and including pulling out a gun and shooting and killing George Zimmerman. And when I started saying this 4 days ago, the right-wingers were going crazy. And I published these pieces on truthout.org and over at Alternet, and they've been picked up and gone all viral all over the Internet. And you wouldn't believe some of the threats and hate mail and whatnot that I get as a consequence of this. But I think this is true. And it hasn't been said by anybody in the corporate mainstream media. And I kept saying, why not? Why isn't somebody saying, what about Trayvon Martin's right to stand his ground? Well, today the president said it. Here he is.
I just ask people to consider, if Trayvon Martin was of age and armed, could he have stood his ground on that sidewalk? And do we actually think that he would have been justified in shooting Mr. Zimmerman, who had followed him in a car, because he felt threatened? And if the answer to that question is at least ambiguous, then it seems to me that we might want to examine those kinds of laws.
Yeah, you think? It seems like a real reasonable thing to examine those kind of laws. He's talking about the Koch brothers, Jeb Bush, ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, Stand Your Ground and Shoot First laws. Because if that Stand Your Ground and Shoot First principle had been applied both to George Zimmerman and to Trayvon Martin, then they both should have had the right to do whatever they wanted to the other. And there would have been no trial. There just would have been a couple of dead bodies. I mean, we're back to duels. We're back to Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. And is that real? Do we really want to go back to 1798? Do we really want to?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, I thought over time we got more civilized, not less civilized. The president had more to say beyond that. We'll play that right after the clip, and we'll pick up your phone calls. Before you are, welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you, the place where smart people get their news. Anything goes Friday. Okay, the president, number one today in his press conference, said, the clip we played for you just about 5 minutes ago, where he said, what if Trayvon Martin had asserted his right to stand his ground? If he had been, 18 years old enough to get a concealed weapons permit and carry a gun, and had simply pulled his gun out and shot George Zimmerman. I mean, now you got a legal conundrum. We need to be looking at this law, which is the point I've been making for weeks. Anyway, very well said, Mr. President. He also opened up, spoke to, in a very brief and elegant way, the issue of race. And I think that you know, I keep saying we need to have a conversation about race in this country, and especially we need to have a conversation about race in this country that is done in a way that white people who don't realize that the conversation about race needs to happen get. Because it is my contention that the vast majority of white people in America who grew up with very little contact with African Americans have no idea what white privilege is, have no idea what the average African American experience is, just don't know. They're not operating off, you know, insane screaming bigotry. I mean, some of them are, of course, but, you know, most of them are just operating off, duh. You know, they just don't know. It's not that they're dumb. It's that they haven't experienced that world. I mean, it's hard enough when, you know, when women talk about sexual assault, it's hard enough for men to understand that. Or it's hard enough, I would assume, for women to understand when, you know, men talk about, you know, whatever the men's issue may be du jour. What was that old men's movement about, recapturing your manhood or something like that? You know, it's like just different genders. We scratch our heads a little bit. You know, the whole John Gray, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. But there's not a man around who hasn't had contact with a woman or vice versa, somehow, some way. But there are a lot of white people who have probably spent much, if not most of their lives, and in some cases all of their lives, with no contact with African Americans beyond what they see on television or in the media or the occasional person that they pass on the street or in the store. And they have no idea. And so in this very, very, very brief comment, I personally believe that the president, in this very brief comment, caused a lot of white people in America to go to have one of those Scooby-Doo moments, you know, the, oh, really? And here's what he had to say.
You know, when Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. And when you think about why, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here, I think it's important to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that doesn't go away.
And then he gave the details.
You know, there are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me. There are very, very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often.
So here is the President of the United States telling white people, I don't think that this was a message directed to African Americans beyond saying, hey, you know, it's important that somebody discuss the issue of race here, because the Trayvon Martin trial was all about race, even though everybody pretended it wasn't. And in fact, the shooting itself right from the get-go was all about race, because George Zimmerman racially profiled Trayvon Martin. So to the extent that the African American community for some time had been calling for the president or somebody of his stature to acknowledge that. And Eric Holder did a pretty good job of that yesterday and the day before, by the way, speaking at the NAACP convention. But, you know, to the extent that he was acknowledging that, yeah. But I think, I don't know if it was intentional. I'm guessing it was, because he's a very smart man. But whether it was intentional, whether he said that thinking, I want to convey this message to white people, or whether it just happened, it was a really important message. The two things that I would have added to it, and I, this is not a critique of what the president said. I mean, you know, if somebody came to me and said, you know, what do you know as a white guy about the black experience, I would say, first, very little. Right? I've never been black. But beyond that, the things that I would add to that are that when white people are in fear of black people, typically they are in fear of the normal stuff that you're afraid of somebody, you know, if you're a white person walking down the street and some thuggish looking white person is following you, the nervousness that you experience falls into the category of, I'm going to get robbed, I'm going to get beat up. Or what a white person might describe as a thuggish looking black person following them. I'm going to get robbed, I'm going to get beat up. It falls into that category. What white people in this country don't realize is that for many African Americans, when they find themselves not just being profiled, but being aggressively followed by somebody who is not African American, as happened to Trayvon Martin, one of the thoughts that goes through their mind is not just, hey, I'm going to get beat up or robbed. It's that that white person can probably kill me and get away with it. Because that's how it works in the United States. A white person killing a black person in a stand your ground state is over 300% more likely to get off than a black person killing a white person. And in a non-stand your ground state, it's over 200% more likely to get off. So I would add that to the dialogue. I think now we're getting into kind of complex stuff. I think the president just did it he did it perfectly. It was simple, it was elegant, it was straightforward, it was something that needed to be said. And I'm very, very pleased that he did it. So that said, back to your calls. We've got a board full of calls. Some of you have been waiting an hour here to hop in, so let me get right to it. Justin in Wailuku, Hawaii?
Wailuku. Yeah, Wailuku. Justin. Aloha, Tom.
Aloha.
Yeah, in Hawaii, our governor, the Democratic governor of Hawaii, Neil Abercrombie, was able to push through a privatization preschool voucher bill, a constitutional amendment that will be on our ballot in 2014. And when he was pushing this, the Hawaii State Teachers Association was asking for help of the National Education Association, and they stood by and they said they couldn't help organize against a voucher bill because they have a policy statement that stated, because of the realities of the current pre-kindergarten market, however, NEA does not oppose the inclusion in a state's universal pre-kindergarten program of private, non-for-profit, non-sectarian providers that meet special criteria. So they stood back and weren't able to help us. And what happened was it passed, and what the state's doing is it's defunding. It's not going to continue to fund the public pre-kindergarten program. So 5,100 kids are not going to be given pre-kindergarten, and teachers, public school teachers, will lose their jobs for the establishment of a voucher bill for preschool.
Yeah.
And I went to the NEA conference and just in the first week of July and told the story and was able to delete that policy statement so NEA would not sit back and allow the establishment of privatization of preschool, universal preschool in any state. And, you know, it's just so sad to see a Democratic governor pushing a voucher bill and then saying it's not a voucher bill.
Increasingly, there's Democrats all over the country who are doing this. And then you've got, like, the Gates Foundation, which, you know, Bill Gates actually made a profit creating the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which blew my mind when I discovered that. and others who you know represent themselves as progressive and forward thinking, who are just playing into this let's privatize education agenda, and let's reform education. Let's get the Justin, thanks for the call. Let's get the teaching to the test nonsense out of it. Let's go back to teachers having some autonomy and independence and style of teaching and all that kind of thing. And let's fund education well, and let's pay our teachers, our teachers hold our future in their hands. Let's pay them well.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But no, instead we're seeing a race to the bottom, and you're seeing a bunch of opportunists coming in and saying, hey, there's got to be some way we can make a buck off education. And sadly, some Democrats are buying into it. Now let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up today?
Well, you're talking about my lead story, of course.
Your news story? What's that?
Your lead story. You're talking about my lead story.
Oh, your lead story. Okay.
The lead story. President Obama making a surprise appearance at the White House press room today to speak about the aftermath of the Trayvon Martin case, saying Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Yep.
Also talking about how that he'd been followed around in a department store and saying, basically there are very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars and talking about things that I think really have shaken up this country this afternoon.
Yeah. Really. And the point that I was making, I just played those clips, and the point that I was making is that I think that most white people in America have no idea. They have
I don't think they have any idea.
Yeah.
We don't have any idea.
Yeah.
No, the only time I've ever experienced prejudice was when I lived in a particular city that didn't like English people very much, and it was a real awakening for me. It was very interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. He also, during these remarks, which lasted less than 20 minutes, came up with some suggestions, three suggestions in particular, to talk about the larger social issues. And one is to get the Justice Department involved with training local governments to reduce mistrust in the legal system. One was to examine local laws like Stand Your Ground and see if they may encourage the kinds of altercations and confrontations and tragedies that we saw in the Florida case rather than diffuse potential altercations.
Yeah.
That was a pretty controversial statement.
Well, the research is in on that. In Stand Your Ground law states, it's 300% more likely that white people killing black people will get off. And in non-Stand Your Ground states, it's only 200% more likely.
Interesting.
It was over in Think Progress yesterday.
And his third one was to think about ways. And he said that this was more of a think piece, if you like, was to think about ways to bolster and reinforce African-American boys so they don't get caught up in the legal system, as the statistics indicate they're more likely to be. So those were the three broad ideas that he raised today.
Yeah. And I'd say for that latter is, I go back to Franklin Roosevelt, the best welfare program in the world is a job. Let's bring our jobs back home. Let's stop our insane trade policies. Let's put this country back to work.
It certainly makes a big difference. And speaking of jobs, in a city with 18.6% unemployment, a Michigan Circuit Court judge ruled today that Detroit's bankruptcy filing is unconstitutional and ordered the case to be withdrawn from federal bankruptcy court.
Now, is that because on Monday of next week, the governor and the little dictator, the emergency manager, Kevin Orr, had a court hearing in which they were trying to lay their grubby little fingers on the pension funds and retirement health funds for city workers, retired city workers, and the city was starting to fight back seriously on that, or people in the city, and so they pulled this bankruptcy thing by way of saying, okay, we'll take the money anyway.
I don't think it's clear exactly why.
Okay.
We do know that the order came in response to motions by lawyers for retirees and pension funds for city workers. Yes.
So.
And they're arguing that the state constitution prohibits cutting pension and retirement benefits, as has been proposed in the bankruptcy case.
Yep.
Now, the Michigan Attorney General said in a statement soon after the decision that he intended an immediate appeal to the Michigan Court of Appeals, and he's going to seek to block this latest order from taking effect while the appeal is heard.
In other words, they want to go to court on Monday and steal the pension money.
They want to go to court on Monday. Those are your words, my words. They want to go to court on Monday and move forward.
Yes. Okay. All right.
That's what they want to do.
Indeed.
So this is going to be dirty. That's my word.
Yes.
Yes.
Move forward is your word. Yes. I'm agreeing with you.
This is going to be dirty.
Acknowledge
it. I did go that far. It's going to be dirty.
Yes.
I will go that far.
I think it already is. Yeah.
John Kerry, the Secretary of State, has announced that Israel and the Palestinians have reached an agreement which establishes the basis for resuming peace talks.
Well, that's great.
Jordan. Yep. Yep. Now, he's giving no details of the agreement. He's being very careful, established the basis. Hopeful the talks will resume
right. If
everything goes as expected. Negotiators would join in within the next week or so, make a further announcement at that time.
Yeah. So now that's a good on you, John Kerry. What about the John Kerry said that if Venezuela takes Ed Snowden, that we're going to stop letting their airplanes fly over U.S. airspace and their airlines come into our country and stuff like that? That seems bizarre.
That's a different John Kerry.
That's the evil John Kerry. My words, not yours.
two angels, you know.
Yeah, one on either shoulder. Amazing.
This is considered a significant step forward. I mean, he's paid six visits to the Middle East in the last very few months to try and get these talks going. It's not clear just how strong the agreement is. And, in fact, some analysts are saying that it's fragile and they could even be derailed before the talks begin. But this is the closest that they've got since negotiations broke off in 2010.
Wow, that's great. And there was basically nothing that ever happened during the Bush presidency, unless I'm misremembering.
Nothing really solidified.
Yeah, I think that George Bush basically put that all on the back burner or whatever. But in any case, okay, so what else is going on in the world?
Hobby Lobby, a national for-profit chain of arts and crafts stores and key plaintiff against the Obama administration's birth control mandate, won a court injunction today allowing it to not provide birth control as part of its insurance plans to employees. It was granted a preliminary injunction.
So do they want all their women employees to get knocked up, right, to get pregnant, or is this their assertion of religion?
It's their assertion of religion. And
I see.
Yes, you can get knocked.
Yeah. It might be the consequence of it. It's
yes.
Very, very strange. It's almost Ken Cuccinelli strange, but we won't go there. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
We will be back with more of Anything Goes Friday right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Fascinating op-ed by Paul Krugman, The Chinese Wall, in today's New York Times. The one sentence in it that I think kind of summarizes the thing that might provoke you to be curious enough that you go read it is, he says, it worked for several decades. Now, however, China has hit the Lewis point. To put it crudely, it is running out of surplus peasants. It's a very, very interesting analysis of not just the Chinese economy, but frankly, how economies make those transitions from developing to developed or from pre-developing to developing and what happens. I would say, you know, we went through something like that ourselves here in the United States in the middle of the 19th century. But in any case, it is Anything Goes Friday here, so, and Anything Goes Summer. And so Rock in Pasco, Washington. Hey, Rock, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call. Bless you.
Sure.
I had two things that I want. Well, I had one, but you brought up another issue. But you know, with the unions, I do believe that, you know, we've made them a promise we have to stand by them. But as far as that, I do believe that.
Well, say, with regard to the, if you're talking about the pension and health benefits, yes, for the retired Detroit workers, those were not promises that were made to a union. Those were promises that were made to individual workers. And those were, those were monies that were taken out of the paychecks of individual workers. And I don't understand how Detroit can claim, or Rick Snyder can claim, that that's an unsecured debt. I realize that there's no, you know, property that you can point to that is the security for it, but I would say this, the good name of the state of Michigan is the security for it.
No, that's what I meant. We made a promise to the union worker, you know, as far as public, but I don't think that the public servant should be making more than the average public person that they're serving.
Right. So let's raise wages in the private sector back to where, you know, I mean, it used to be, prior to the Reagan administration, it used to be that public service workers on average made less than private service workers, private industry workers. And people went into the public into the public sector. They became teachers or bureaucrats or administrators or got jobs with various agencies or whatever, not because they wanted to make more money, but because there was job security. They knew that it was a good, you know, 20, 30 years and you can retire with a pension kind of thing. And now, because there has been this war on labor that has been so aggressively waged for 32 years now with Reaganomics, in the private industry, the private sector, wages have just collapsed, particularly in those right to work for less states. And what is left is the government sector, because A, they're heavily unionized, and B, you know, they did make long-term commitments to their workers. And I agree with you. We need to bring the pay of the private sector back up to where it used to be relative to the public sector.
Right. And then the other thing I wanted to say is you know, once again, keep the Martin family in your prayers. But Trayvon did stand his ground, and I think that he chose the wrong person to do it with. I mean, what Zimmerman, that's not saying it was okay what he did, but he did stand his ground, obviously, you know, but he chose the wrong person to stand his ground against.
Perhaps. We don't know that to be the case, but that raises the question. Did he have the right to stand his ground?
Well, I believe he did.
Okay,
know,
then
I mean, you
then,
know.
Then if you have your right, if you have a right to stand your ground, then the other person does not have the right to shoot you.
I'm not sure what the... You know, nobody was there. Nobody saw. You know, I mean,
no. Just in the abstract. Just in the abstract. This is why the stand your ground and shoot first law is so dumb. Because what it says is whoever shoots first wins.
Well, you know, and then the other thing is with the you know, I mean, I don't agree with like a lot of the stuff you say, but I love listening to your show because I get the other view. You know, and the other point of you know, I mean, your viewers and your listeners, and I love hearing that other side. But, you know, as far as, you know, carrying a firearm, I am a concealed carry person. And First you're taught that, you know, I mean, you don't walk around with, you're supposed to walk around ready to go because for the simple fact, you're supposed to be trained. You're supposed to walk around ready to go for the simple fact that the bad guy's not going to be, oh, well, you know, hold on, let me load a chamber or let me.
Right, but if the bad guy is unarmed, typically you would not shoot to kill.
Like I said, you know, I mean, that the Zimmerman thing is there's a whole, I don't know exactly where I sit, but I mean.
And if the bad guy is the one that you've been stalking, Rock, you with the gun, if you're stalking somebody half your age and you confront that and you physically confront them.
I don't agree with you guys when you say he was stalking him. I don't agree with that because.
Okay, if you're following somebody half your age and they turn around and confront you.
He didn't know he was half his age, and wasn't he walking slowly, you know, kind of meandering? And I mean, wouldn't that? I mean, not saying once again.
There is no testimony to that effect except George Zimmerman's testimony, and it defies common sense.
Yeah.
If you look at the 7-Eleven videotapes, it was raining out there. He was wearing, and he did not have a raincoat. He had an umbrella. He had a hoodie. He came in. He bought the Skittles and the can of iced tea. He was, and the Skittles were for his nephew, I guess, his younger kid who was with him. He had been playing video games. He wanted to get back to those video games. I believe he was probably moving as quickly as he could. And in fact, George Zimmerman was like, you know, he's running away, and I'm losing sight of him. That doesn't sound to me like he's meandering. That was one of many times that George Zimmerman contradicted himself, or also known as lied.
And like I said, you know, we lost a young person. I mean, it's sad to lose anybody.
It's not sad. It's a crime.
But
it's a crime.
The family and the prayer, you know. And I mean, like I said, I don't agree with what he did, you know. But the jury.
With what? Who did?
What Zimmerman did.
Oh, okay.
I don't agree with it, you know. But I you know, once again, the jury made their decision, and I respect that. But you know, if I agree with it or not.
But I think they did it. I think the jury made the decision based on faulty jury instructions on a really.
That's the other thing
pathetic prosecution.
Before the verdict came out, everybody, you know, I was listening once again to the left radio because, I mean, I like listening to the other side and hearing what they have to say and just kind of learning a little more, different things, you know. But, you know, everybody was all for the prosecutor. Oh, yeah, he's doing a great job. He's got it in the bag. And then as soon as the verdict came off, they were like, oh, he didn't know what he was doing. He didn't, you know, I mean, yeah. This guy, he shouldn't have been. And I don't get that. I mean, you know, before the verdict came out, they were all for him.
Yeah.
He's doing a great job. And then after it came out, they're like, oh, he didn't know what he was doing.
Well, for the record, Rock, you will not be able to find anywhere in any of my programming where I said the prosecutor was doing a great job. I in fact, my concern was that they were trying to prosecute a case that they couldn't support. That second degree murder would have been very, very difficult to support. And that's why I said, I think in all probability, this jury is going to go back and they're going to say, two guys met on a dark night. One of them had a gun, one didn't. The one who didn't have the gun ended up dead. Somebody's got to be at fault for that. It's just like, you know, and it's like manslaughter. I mean, this is like, you know, and it should be probably third degree manslaughter, which, by the way, the judge did not allow. But I thought that, you know, a manslaughter conviction was going to come back. And I think pretty much everybody else in the country thought that. There would seem to be a consensus among most commentators. But, you know.
I appreciate you taking my call and listening
okay.
to what I have to say.
Thank you, Rod.
Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle. Hey, Mark, you got an update on the Occupy National Gathering?
Yeah, Tom, I've been actually writing a book about the Occupy movement this
okay.
year and also writing over there at Truth.
You got a minute to get to it quickly, please.
There's a national gathering scheduled for Kalamazoo, Michigan, August 21st through the 25th, and you can go to OccupyNationalGathering.net for all of the information. They've chosen Michigan because of all the bankruptcies that are going on there, so they figure it's a perfect time to talk about economic austerity measures and economic injustice. So the Occupy movement is still alive, and to quote Mark Twain again, the rumors of its demise have been greatly exaggerated, so people
right.
should pay attention.
Plus, you can check out the Kalamazoo River and see what happens when tar sands oil gets into a waterway. Mark Taylor Canfield, thank you, sir. Great to hear the report. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour on Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Oh, the Pope had something to say about the tyranny of capitalism? Really? Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Catherine in Wheatland, Wyoming. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, thanks for listening to AM 760. What's on your mind?
Thanks. Well, something very strange just happened. I was reading an article from Reader Supported News, a reprint of an article from International Business Times.
Mm-hmm.
And the title is Jimmy Carter, U.S. Has No Functioning Democracy. Well, it turns out that on Tuesday, the America Bruca met in Atlanta with Jimmy Carter and a bunch of other American businesses trying to work to make a better working relationship between Germany and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And when Jimmy Carter said that he didn't think that, he said because of the NSA spying scandal, that he thinks essentially there's been a suspension of American democracy.
Yes, and he spoke well of Ed Snowden.
Yes, he did. Well, you know, they said that no American media was reporting this, and that you couldn't get the report in full except in the German version of Der Spiegel. Well, I speak in and read German, so I Googled Der Spiegel Jimmy Carter.
Right.
And I got Amazon
mm-hmm.
website.
Right.
So then I Googled Der Spiegel auf Deutsch, Jimmy Carter, and I got Amazon's website again. So then I went up to my address bar and I put in www.spiegel.de, and I got the German version of Der Spiegel, the new one, but I went through every single article, and I swear to God, that article is not there.
Hmm.
There's nothing about Jimmy Carter in it at all.
Very interesting. You know.
But the representative from Der Spiegel, his name, let's see, Gregor Peter Schmidt.
Yeah.
He said on Twitter that he was present at the event and that the story did appear in the German version of Der Spiegel.
Yeah.
So now I'm thinking, oh, am I like the Chinese? Is my government suddenly blocking me from reading things?
I don't know. You might want to just try a different search engine to start out with. Try DuckDuckGo.com.
Okay, but going directly from www.spiegel.de is about as direct as you can get.
You're right. You're right. And you use the search engine on Der Spiegel's own website?
Yes.
Huh. I don't know, Catherine. I did see that story about, you know, Jimmy Carter speaking well of Snowden and saying that we functionally no longer have a democracy here, or that it's being called into question. I didn't do a long rant on it because I only saw it from a single source, and I didn't know the context well enough to feel comfortable. I figured over the weekend I'd look this thing up. Plus, it's not the kind of thing that, you know, is time sensitive. So if I talked about it on Monday, it would be just as good as I talked about it today. And now you've really got me curious. Let me see what I can find out. But
yeah, please. I'll listen Monday. I'm an entrepreneur. I run my own business.
Mm-hmm.
So this time that I've been, I don't often call because when your program is on, I'm working.
Yeah.
But today I thought, boy, I want Tom Hartman to know about this.
Yeah. Well, let me see what I can find out. I'll poke around. I can't do it while I'm on the air. But and maybe somebody in the chat room will see. In fact, somebody, Sandalwood, just noted in the chat room, according to Der Spiegel, quoted Carter as saying the United States presently has no functioning democracy. But let me just check the chat room real quickly here and see if there's actual link to Der Spiegel. So you might want to, wait a minute. Here's the link. Try www.spiegel.de/thema/, this is all lowercase, /Jimmy_Carter/. And then here's another link. The story appeared in German. This right. Benedict has it, http://www.spiegel.de/politik, spelled the German way, POTILIK, / Ausland, AUSLAND, foreign land, /NSA-AFFAERE-Jimmy-Carter-Christiert, KRISIERT-USA-A-911589.html. If you get over, and Lava Q says the Benedict link is better. But apparently it's there because people in the chat room, two different people in our chat room just found it. So keep looking. And if you go over to TomHartman.com, you can log into our chat room. It's, it's free. And it'll be there. And I'm sure that Sue will gather this up and put it together in our compilation of our links. So if you subscribe to our newsletter, you'll get that either tomorrow or the next day. And if you've got our app, our iPhone app, it'll be on that too. Okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Catherine. It's so cool having a live chat room with lots of smart people in it while I'm on the air. It's like, instant information. Let's check the encyclopedia. Fernando in Chicago. Hey, Fernando, we got a minute. What's up?
Oh, thank you, Tom, for taking my call. Listen, first-time caller, I have a question and I have a comment. First of all, the comment is if Trayvon Martin confronted Zimmerman with insult and with aggression like that, he maybe we could say that's what causes his life.
Could be. Nobody knows.
Right? Yeah. Nobody knows. Now, second of the question now is if Zimmerman had killed him with his own physical strength, not with a weapon, but with his hands, let's say, with his butt, with his feet, whatever, but with his body instead of a weapon, would that make it more, how can I say, more legal?
I think it would have made his argument of self-defense probably a little more plausible, but again, the fact that there was no George Zimmerman DNA and no George Zimmerman blood found on Trayvon Martin's hands at all kind of puts a hole in George Zimmerman's argument that Trayvon Martin beat him up. It certainly raises questions for me. Fernando, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Once again, the president made some comments today about the Trayvon Martin case and about race in America. Really important stuff. Check it out. Welcome back to the program, by the way. I continue to be amazed and impressed by Pope Francis. It's enough to make somebody convert to Catholicism. I say that only half facetiously. I mean, it's the Pope. This Pope is just saying remarkable things that need to be said, much like what the president said needed to be said. Here's the Pope is saying. He just had a meeting with ambassadors from a whole bunch of other countries. Now, keep in mind, he is a head of state as well as the head of a church. The state is the Vatican. They are a member of the United Nations. They are officially one of the nations of the world, a voting member. In fact, they have a voting seat on the United Nations Committee on Birth Control and women's issues, reproductive issues, which I find a little head-scratching. But in any case, or at least they did when I visited John Paul II. I don't know if they still do, but back then they did. So, but that all that said, which sounds like I'm kicking the Catholic Church. I'm not. I'm just saying. But here's what Pope Francis had to say. He said free market capitalism has created a tyranny, and that in the context of this tyranny, human beings are being judged only by our ability to consume goods. In other words, we're only being viewed as consumers by this marketplace. He says money should be made to serve people, not to rule them. He says countries should impose more control over their economies and not allow absolute autonomy in order to provide for the common good. Let me reverse the sentence. In order to provide for the common good, countries should impose more control over their economies and not allow absolute autonomy. That's what he said, or the meaning of what he said. He said that the joy of life is being reduced around in many of the developed countries because of the gap between the rich and the poor. He said, this is a verbatim quote, while the income of a minority is increasing exponentially, that of the majority is crumbling. He said, quote, verbatim quote, the worship of the golden calf of old has found a new and heartless image in the cult of money and the dictatorship of an economy which is faceless and lacking any true human goal. And then he went on to say unchecked capitalism. Now, of course, that's, you know, libertarian. That's Ayn Rand. This, you know, unchecked capitalism has created a new, invisible, and at times virtual tyranny. Wow. The president today, I think, you know, these are such important comments. They bear repeating, and I know that there's a bunch of you on hold, and I will get to your calls in just a second. But I just want to play these two clips from President Obama one more time because they are so touching and so to the point. And the first was President Obama saying what I've been saying on this program for some time now, particularly since the verdict came out in the trial, which is that, I mean, he's not saying it the way I'm saying it, but I mean, speaking to this point, shall we say, that both Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman were on trial. George Zimmerman was on trial for killing Trayvon Martin, and his defense was that Trayvon Martin was a bad guy threatening him. So then the sub-trial of that was that Trayvon Martin was on trial. Was he guilty of threatening George Zimmerman? Now, if he was guilty of threatening George Zimmerman, then George Zimmerman had a legitimate self-defense defense. But if Trayvon Martin was not guilty of threatening George Zimmerman, then George Zimmerman had no defense. So both of them were on trial, but the standard that was used to judge George Zimmerman was, did he feel frightened for his own bodily safety? And if he did, then he had the right to pull the trigger and kill his kid. The standard that was used for Trayvon Martin, just ask any right winger in America, the standard that was used for Trayvon Martin was, why didn't he run? It was the pre-2006, pre-Koch Brothers, NRA, Alec, Jeb Bush, pre-stand your ground, shoot first law. That was the standard that was used for Trayvon Martin. You know, right wingers keep saying, why didn't he run? He had 4 minutes. He could have gotten home during that time. So Trayvon Martin did not have a right to stand his ground. George Zimmerman did, by that logic. And I keep pointing this out, and people keep going, really? Well, here's the president pointing it out.
I just ask people to consider, if Trayvon Martin was of age and armed, could he have stood his ground on that sidewalk? And do we actually think that he would have been justified in shooting Mr. Zimmerman, who had followed him in a car, because he felt threatened? And if the answer to that question is at least ambiguous, then it seems to me that we might want to examine those kinds of laws.
We might want to, yeah. 31 states, we have stand your ground, shoot first laws put there by the National Rifle Association, the Koch brothers, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and they're virtually always Republican toadies. And it's time to seriously examine those laws, number one. And number two, he said, by the way, you white people out there who have never had much contact with African Americans, you should know that life is different for us than it is for you. The president, I mean, again, I'm paraphrasing. You'll hear his actual quote in just a minute. But I keep saying on this program, and I've been saying it for a long, long time, I didn't know what white privilege was until well into my adult life. I don't think most white people understand what white privilege is. And I don't think most white people have any idea what the experience of being black in America is. And so the president did some educating today, and I think it was really important that white people in America hear this. Now, I realize that there was an explosion of white right-wingers hysterical about this. Hugh Hewitt, this POTUS presser is remarkable, like he fell through the time tunnel to his state Senate days. And Republican Brian Walsh, remarkable that the president of the United States continues to fan the flames on George Zimmerman. And Joe Pollack writes at Breitbart.com, Obama backs the race baiters. And Joe Walsh, President Obama is making this all about race. And Dana Loesch, it's a combo protest diversion from scandals and attempt to weaken laws protecting the right to self-defense. And Tammy Bruce and Ben Shapiro and Dan Rea. There's a whole list of all these tweets from all these right-wingers over at thinkprogress.org. But you know, who are objecting to the fact that he's saying, hey, by the way, you white people, and by no coincidence, I don't think all these people who are attacking him are white. He says, by the way, you white people, those of us who grew up black and male in America have a slightly different experience of the world. Here is his saying that.
You know, when Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. And when you think about why, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here, I think it's important to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that that doesn't go away. There are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me. There are very, very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often.
So there you go. The president's saying, this is, you know, welcome to my world. It's pretty amazing. I think that, frankly, those simple comments are some of the best comments on race in America that I've heard in a long, long time. Nancy in Boulder. Hey, Nancy, what's up?
Hi, yeah. Before I get to my topic, the President Carter in Germany, talk is on Democracy Now.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. I'm concerned because Stand Your Ground can easily legalize assassination, including multiple assassination. And this is a clear and present danger to all law-abiding citizens.
Yes.
Regardless of race.
Yeah, it basically legalizes duels.
It legalizes duels, but you could do it in mass. If people want to, you know, attack protesters or whatever in mass, you could probably get away with it. And I'm thinking that, the question comes to mind, what did the Koch brothers have in mind when they installed these in this 30-some states?
I don't think the Koch brothers cared so much about it. The major funders of this thing were the National Rifle Association, and what they had in mind was that the gun manufacturers that they shill for could make more money because they sell more guns and more ammunition. If people felt that by walking around with a concealed weapon, they reduced the risk that they themselves might end up in jail if anything happened that, untoward, like, you know, in the case of George Zimmerman. Nancy, thank you for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's Anything Goes Friday. And check out our new free app for the iPhone and the iPad over at the App Store. It's Tom Hartman. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Harbin, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Daniel Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program, Dow Global, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, CRN Network, Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and all the others, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on our TV show, The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, to Jen for filling in and answering the phones today. Thank you, Jen. You're doing a spectacular job. And to you for supporting our program. Thank you for listening and for watching, whatever it may be, and for letting our affiliates know, or however you're getting this show, that, you know, if assuming that you like it, that you do. And if you don't, let them know that too, I suppose. You certainly let me know from time to time. We could publish a book titled, Death Threats Against a Talk Show Host or something like that. Anyhow, Larry in Lancaster, California. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind?
Hey, Paul, I have a couple points. One is, what makes you think Zimmerman was profiling?
Well, you mean racially profiling or profiling? There's no disputing that he was profiling in as much as he was determining that this guy was suspicious, that he was not where he belonged. That's kind of a definition of profiling. The question was the fact that he was black part of that profiling? And I think the answer is fairly clearly, obviously, yes, because every single one of the 30 plus or 40 plus previous phone calls that George Zimmerman had made to 911 had been about black people in his neighborhood.
Right, and who were arrested for breaking in homes around there is black people. So that's not a profile, that's just telling the facts.
Well, no, that would be profiling. It would be profiling based on the past, but it would be profiling. And A, and
okay,
B, we don't know. It was never introduced into evidence that there were any multiple numbers of break-ins or that they were always caused by black people. None of those things were ever asserted. They were implied by the defense getting one white woman to testify that two black guys had broken into her house and scared the bejesus out of her. That was the only thing that had to do with crime in that neighborhood that was actually introduced as evidence in the trial. Everything else was conjecture on your part.
Okay, and then Trayvon was standing his ground because apparently Zimmerman was losing the fight. So why doesn't Zimmerman have the right to defend himself?
Well, that's the question. If they both had the right to stand their ground, then they both had the right to kill the other. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. What kind of crazy law does that?
Well, if you take away the stand your ground law...
And you go back to the way the laws were in Florida from the mid-19th century up until 2005, which is before you can resort to deadly force, you have to try everything else first, including negotiation and including running, removing yourself from the situation. And
if Trayvon was on top of him, he couldn't run, and he was getting his head apparently beaten into the ground. I don't know if you ever been in a fight. I don't know if you ever been in one, but if you've been in one and you're losing, you're going to think.
I have been in several fights, and I have lost badly in virtually all of them. They were all when I was much, much younger, when I was, you know, 11, 12, 13 years old. The kid who lived up the street from me was the school bully, and he used to love to beat the crap out of me, and I have had him sitting on my stomach on more than one occasion, and I have never killed. I was scared to death, but I never pulled a gun and shot him.
No, but you're scared, and you don't know what's going to happen.
It does under the law right now. You are right. Under the stand your ground, shoot first laws promoted by the National Rifle Association and the Crotch Brothers, that does give you the right to kill somebody. It shouldn't.
Under the defense law, if you can't get away and he was under Trayvon, he had no choice.
There is a doctrine called the first aggressor. Are you familiar with this? Okay, this is Florida law, and it's called the initial aggressor, actually. And here's what the law says. A defendant in Florida cannot claim self-defense if he initially provokes the use of force against himself, unless he either withdraws from the conflict and conveys the withdrawal to the other party, the legal equivalent of saying uncle, or uses reasonable escape options to avoid death or great bodily harm. In other words, the initial aggressor has no right to stand his ground. He must retreat, the initial aggressor. Now, if this incident is only being clocked from the moment that Trayvon Martin swung his fist at George Zimmerman, assuming that happened, then that makes Trayvon Martin the initial aggressor. And that's the way that that George Zimmerman's lawyers played it out. But if this incident was clocked from the moment George Zimmerman got out of his car and started walking toward Trayvon Martin, which is what I think is logical and legal, then the initial aggressor instruction should have been given to the jury. Don West, when the prosecution asked for this instruction to be given to the jury, Don West said, and I quote, "Well, let me point out as a matter of law that following somebody on foot or car is not against the law. That cannot be considered provocation under the law. Force means physical force, the threat of physical force. It would be an error and, frankly, promoting a miscarriage of justice if the state were allowed that to be argued to the jury." And so the judge, in other words, I will appeal based on this. And the judge said, okay, this court is not going to give that instruction. And I think they should have. I think that was a horrible mistake made by the defense, that the initial aggressor was George Zimmerman, and therefore he had no right to claim self-defense because he initiated the chain of events that led to his being on the ground, being beaten up, assuming that that's actually how it played out. And so, Larry, thank you for the call. But that, I mean, this, I don't think you even need to be a lawyer. This is just common sense stuff. Coming up Monday, all the latest news and information from the weekend. Plus, care for a little salt in your food? Your report is out shaking up the CDC's recommendations, but is it bad science? Michelle Minton of the Competitive Enterprise Institute going to drop by. Don't forget to tag your
listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.